Banda versus D'Angelo. Mr. Myers.
May I please court, Mr. King? Your Honor, my name is Chris Myers. I represent the appellants in this case, Amy Gephardt and Nathan Alexander. I'll briefly discuss the facts. Joseph D'Angelo was a police officer for the city of Fort Wayne. He was involved.
Can you speak up a little?
Yes, sir, I'm sorry. Joseph D'Angelo was a police officer for the city of Fort Wayne. He was involved in a task force that was designed to target bad police officers on the force. He targeted Nate Alexander, and he went about setting up Nate Alexander. And his goal was to get Nate charged with the crime of patronizing a prostitute. He needed a woman to do that. He first contacted Jennifer Silvers. She said no, so she implicated Amy Gephardt. D'Angelo, to get Amy Gephardt to cooperate, set Amy up in a drug conspiracy charge. And that was for the sole purpose of gaining her cooperation to serve as a prostitute and to go after Nate Alexander.
Could I ask you, Mr. Myers, one thing that concerns me about this utterly distasteful set of facts is how we're going to draw the line in the future between voluntary cooperation by cooperating witnesses or, you know, whatever category you want to put Gephardt in, and coerced, because that's something that was focused on, and it's certainly true that she cooperated because she thought she was in legal trouble on the drug deal, and because she thought that she would get a break on either charges or sentences. But that's run of the mind, right? That's almost always the case with cooperating witnesses. Why was her coercion enough worse? Is it just because of the type of activity or what?
I think it does go to the type of activity and to the rights that Ms. Gephardt enjoyed. She was forced to have sex when she did not want
to. Well, she wasn't forced. She made a choice. Now, what was her criminal exposure?
Your Honor, looking at the facts in the drug conspiracy, I think they were very minimal. This crime was clearly just made up.
Well, is it your argument that they defrauded her, rape by fraud or battery by fraud, that she only agreed to have sex because she thought she was exposed to 40 years prison, but she wasn't? Is that your argument?
That is absolutely correct. And furthermore, Your Honor,
but what was her criminal exposure? You say minimal, but I...
Well, Your Honor, they said it was 40 years. But when she asked for a lawyer...
Yes, they said 40 years, right.
They
so
said
what,
40
what
years.
What was it?
Well, she was never charged with anything.
No, I understand, but...
What could she have been charged with?
Right.
Your Honor, I don't know. I really don't know what she could have been charged with. I know that she was told that she would be facing 40 years. When she asked for a lawyer to see what was up and what her real exposure was, they said no. They kept her from seeing a lawyer. She wanted to see a lawyer. She wanted to find out exactly what your question goes to. What was my real exposure in this case? Well, I think that everyone knew. I think that D'Angelo knew. Really, it was nothing.
Now, they argue that she did still have about 2.5 days in which she could have found a lawyer, notwithstanding their telling her that she shouldn't do so. Is it also part of your case that she was just too afraid or intimidated or somehow under their thumb?
Absolutely. The coercion, the consent was coerced from the beginning. The timeline, I think, is irrelevant. She could not have seen a lawyer. They were watching her. She was afraid that she was going to go to jail.
Is that the record, that she was under surveillance during that period of time?
I believe that she was under surveillance much of the time. I don't know that she was under surveillance all of the time, but I know it is in the record that they told her, if you do see a lawyer, it's off, you're going to go to jail. And she actually feared that when she was coerced into having sex with Nate Alexander. In any event, a meeting was set up. She was given a napkin. She was told to collect the semen of Mr. Alexander to spit it out on the napkin. She did that. She returned it to the officers. Mr. Alexander was then prosecuted for patronizing a prostitute, a totally pretextual charge. My client was not prosecuted. She didn't suffer jail time ultimately, but she didn't know that when these events unfolded. So the question...
And they later dropped all these charges against Mr. Alexander, too.
Yes, they did.
Why, for instance, the cable theft? I mean, I suppose, I don't know whether that's within the...
Well, Your Honor, the record isn't very well developed on any of those charges, but none of these charges really had any teeth of them whatsoever. All of these things were totally made up. The record concentrates on the patronizing a prostitute charge, because that indeed was the charge that got Mr. Alexander kicked off the force.
How much publicity, if any, was there with regard to these?
Your Honor, there were newspaper articles. My client talked in her deposition, I believe that I made that part of the appendix, that she was humiliated, she was called a prostitute. There was a lot of publicity about this in the Fort Wayne newspapers. The question on appeal is whether either Nate Alexander or Amy Gifford enjoyed any kind of substantive due process rights that were violated by the conduct of Joseph DeAngelo. We maintain that entrapping, ensnaring a confidential informant, threatening her with incarceration and jail time and prosecution, forcing her to become really nothing more than a sexual vesicle, is absolutely in violation of her substantive due process rights.
Now, it's always a hard argument to say that you're down to substantive due process, given how high the threshold the Supreme Court has set in cases like the County of Sacramento against Lewis for something that shocks the conscience. It doesn't even shock the conscience to kill someone through a reckless chase. Why did this qualify?
Your Honor, in County of Sacramento, even though the chase was reckless, the harm was not intended. This court commented on County of Sacramento in Armstrong, and I think that even though we didn't sign it or we're going to a long analysis of it, I think Armstrong is probably the best case to look to as far as substantive due process in this circuit. And in this case, as distinguished from County of Sacramento, the harm was intentional from the get-go. Joseph DeAngelo set about to perform his scheme immediately from the beginning. He deliberated about it. He intended to do it. At each and every step, he knew what he was doing. Every step culminated and ended up violating my client's constitutional rights. Totally in opposite to a set of circumstances where his conduct was accidental or even reckless.
Could I just ask you a technical point? You're appearing here today on behalf of both Mr. Alexander and Ms. Gifford?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. To explain that, they were friends before all this started.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they had some issues shortly after it all came to pass. They became friends again. And I looked into it, whether I had a conflict. I don't think I do. In Armstrong, this court set out the due process analysis that it employs. The first question is whether due process clause guards against the challenged conduct. I think clearly that it does. The second is whether DeAngelo's conduct offended the standards of substantive due process. And there are two of them that I want to talk about. I concentrated in my brief on the shock to the conscience standard, although I think in this case the court could resort to the less hostile, deliberate indifferent standard. And I say that because, as this court stated in Armstrong, shocks to the conscience isn't the only way to get to a substantive due process claim.
Mr. Myers, are there state remedies that they might have pursued?
No. I don't think there's any state remedy that would have cured the defects that happened here. And furthermore, even if there were, I think that the court in Armstrong indicated that
I thought the case was filed in state court and removed.
It was. It was originally filed in state court.
So you must have thought that there were state remedies.
No, sir. I truly didn't. I didn't have...
Wait, I don't understand. You filed a case not thinking there was any remedy?
It was based on federal law, though,
it
right?
It was based on federal law, and the Allen Superior Court has jurisdiction of Section 1983 claims. And, Your Honor, as a practical matter, I represent plaintiffs. These people were indigent. They didn't have any money. The filing fee in state court is only $107. But regardless, the Allen Superior Court does have jurisdiction.
But I don't understand your argument about absence of state remedies. The simplest way to look at this case for you, forgetting outrageous conduct and shocking the conscience and all this, is that this is some kind of a battery or rape, because she was deceived into consenting to sex by being misinformed as to her criminal exposure.
That may be true, Your Honor, but that does not take it out of the constitutional realm.
No, on the contrary, it puts it in it much, much more securely, right? It's, you know, deprivation of, if a police officer under color of state law using his badge or something rapes someone, that obviously is a violation of the Constitution.
That's correct.
So this is an indirect form of this. The rape is by another person, but it's arranged by the police, and it's a rape because it's procured by threats. So you clearly have state remedies for that kind of battery. So I don't know why we have to get into outrageous conduct and shocking the conscience.
Because, Your Honor, as a practical matter, by the time my clients came to me, the tort claims notice time had run. I was not their first attorney. They did not file a tort claims notice to preserve their state law remedy.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so, practically speaking, this was
right.
the only way.
Okay.
But I think that it's a viable way. I noticed that my light's on and I reserve
okay, my... Okay, fine. Time. Thank you, Mr. Myers. Mr. Kane? Before you start, I have a preliminary question. Why did you remove... I have two preliminary questions. First, why did you remove this case to federal court?
Because, as Mr. Myers indicated, it did state claims under Section 1983, which, of course, are removable to federal court, and I...
Of course they're removable, but the whole theory of providing this 1983, this federal remedy litigable in federal court, is that state courts are supposed to be... favorable to state entities, police and cities and the like, and the state court's supposed to be a forum friendly to public officials. So it's just very puzzling why you would want to remove it.
Two practical reasons. First of all, the judges in federal court are much more familiar with these claims. State court judges rarely see them, aren't knowledgeable about them, and frankly, the summary judgment standard is better in federal court for defendants than it is in Indiana
okay.
state court.
Okay, thanks.
How are the judges selected in Fort Wayne?
The judges in Fort Wayne are elected judges.
There was a lot of publicity about this case, wasn't there?
There was some, yes. There was publicity
favorable
about these cases.
Favorable to the police department?
I would say it was unfavorable in that Mr. Alexander was a police officer, so however you viewed the case, it was unfavorable to the police because it was a police officer involved in this circumstance, and he was ultimately terminated. Not for violations per se of any criminal law, but because he was found of committing conduct that was unbecoming to a police officer. And Mr. Alexander freely admitted that he had sex with Ms. Gefford in his police car, not only this time, but other times before, and with other women on numerous occasions in his police car.
How would you classify Ms. Gefford in this situation? A cooperating individual?
She was a cooperating individual. And
do you cooperating individuals often complete the crime?
I would say sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Certainly,
with respect to apart from this, how, for example, in a drug situation where a cooperating individual would complete the crime?
Well, certainly the cooperating individual will actually make the purchase of the drugs.
Use the drugs as well?
Well, not ordinarily. I would agree that not ordinarily it happens, but sometimes it happens if it's a long-term investigation looking to get higher figures. You might have cooperating witnesses that use drugs that they purchase and they don't want to go in and arrest those people
wait, back up a minute. So in a situation where a police officer would send a cooperating individual in to purchase the drugs, you also expect in some situations they would use the drugs they purchased?
I don't know if you'd expect it, but sometimes it does happen that
they
don't.
They did expect it in this case, didn't they? They talked about taking in a handkerchief and putting the semen in a handkerchief.
I agree. They did. They did expect it in this case, that would occur. But this was dealing with people that had sexual relations together before.
That doesn't make any difference.
Yeah. What's that got to do with anything?
It has to do with whether or not Ms. Geppert was coerced into the situation, into involving herself in a sexual relationship with Alexander when she already had a sexual relationship with him.
But this is summary judgment. She says she was coerced. Why should we resolve that disputed fact in your favor?
Because her attorney says she was coerced, but Judge Lee decided this case based upon her own deposition testimony, where repeatedly in her deposition, when I questioned her about what was said by the officers, what they asked her to do, she never used the words that they told me I had to do these things. They made me do them.
That's not the point at all. The point is, was she in fact exposed to a 40-year prison?
Yes. The charges that she was subject to arrest for was conspiracy to sell cocaine, two counts. Her transaction, which was with another law enforcement officer, not Officer D'Angelo, where she took money to buy cocaine for this officer, they had that whole transaction reviewed by a deputy prosecutor who concluded there was probable cause to charge her with two counts of conspiracy to sell cocaine. So she was looking at legitimate criminal charges.
But my question was, was she exposed to some realistic possibility of being sentenced to 40 years?
Absolutely, because of those two charges of conspiracy to sell cocaine to an undercover police officer that she admits that she did, and she doesn't even.
What is the punishment for that?
I'm not sure whether that's a C felony or a D felony.
Well,
I don't understand.
Look, I asked you, was she subject to 40 years? And you say she could have been prosecuted for conspiracy. Well, that's not responsive to my question.
Okay. The prosecuting attorney found that she was subject to being charged with felony counts of conspiracy to sell cocaine. The record from the police officers say that she was subject to 40 years imprisonment. There's no evidence in the record she was not. There's been no evidence presented that what they told her about what she was subject to was in any way an error. So what we have is an argument.
You just have to look in a book to see that, don't you? I mean, that's right.
Well, that's not been
judicial notice.
It's not been an issue in this case so far, but whether the crimes for which she could have been charged subjected her to that type of punishment. Now, the plaintiff's counsel wants to argue that these weren't legitimate crimes, that she really didn't commit them. But Judge Lee found that there was probable cause based upon the fact that the prosecutor looked at the whole transaction and found there was probable cause to believe that she committed these crimes because she admits she took money to sell drugs, to buy drugs for an undercover police officer.
But if she had refused to have sex with Alexander, would she in fact have been sent to prison for 40 years?
Well, of course, that's up to the judge and the criminal prosecution. The point is she was subject to that. It's just like every case where someone's arrested and there's a question about whether they're willing to become an informant or not in order to either have a lesser sentence or to avoid criminal prosecution. There's always this balancing about, you know, is the person going to be convicted on this charge? What is the sentence likely to be? It isn't always open and shut from either side.
But there's a big difference because ordinarily, I mean, I suppose there are cases where these confidential informants assume risks, but ordinarily, if a confidential informant is just told to, you know, make a kind of transaction that Judge Kaney asked you about, there's no particular cost incurred by the CI. But if he's asked to cut off his left hand or something, or else go to jail for 40 years, then it's, you know, highly material whether he's being given a realistic picture of his options.
I think the police are only required to give the confidential informant the information about what they're subject to, not making
really?
A prediction
but
about
you, I mean,
what they're...
You emphasized her prior sexual experience with Alexander, but suppose there was none, and suppose she was some, you know, blushing virgin or something like that, and the police say, you know, I know you find it's very repulsive conduct to engage in, but it's either that or we're going to send you to prison for life.
Okay.
And if that were a false statement, wouldn't she have a good claim?
Okay. In this case, no one...
Well, answer my question. She have a good claim in that case?
No, because I think that the person has the right, the confidential informant...
So you're saying, no, even though it's a lie, right, they're lying, it's not a 100-year exposure, you still say she would have no claim.
The confidential informant has the right...
Would you answer my question?
Yes, I don't think she would, because the
even in my hypothetical case?
Yes, because I think the confidential informant has to make the choice about whether they want to go through the criminal justice system.
But what if the choice is contaminated by lies on the part of the police? So it's not a free, not an informed choice. It's a choice made in induced ignorance.
But that presumes that the police have an obligation under the Constitution to fully inform a confidential informant about what
they're doing. Fully inform. In my case, which is extremely simple and which you're avoiding, the police tell her that she has an exposure 100 years in prison. And let's say, in fact, they know perfectly well her maximum exposure is 5 years. Now, in that case, when they lie and induce her to engage in an act that is very distasteful to her, are you saying there still is no constitutional claim?
I don't believe there would be, because I don't think the police have the obligation to be fully disclosed or tell a criminal suspect.
Well, what you're saying is they don't have the obligation to tell the truth. It's one thing to say full disclosure doesn't have to take place. It's another thing to put a flat-out lie in the table, 100 years versus 5.
I think police do that all the time when they're dealing with criminal suspects. They don't necessarily have to tell them 100% of the truth about everything that they know.
Why do you translate a lie into not telling 100% of the truth? You equate those two. We don't think of those as identical acts.
Right, I agree. But I'm saying I don't think the police are obligated to not lie. Under the Constitution to not lie.
They can lie blatantly, even though that induces a person to engage in what would otherwise be battery or some other.
But if the issue is consent, it's different from the issue in some of these other cases. And if the police, you know, walk in and lie and say your accomplice has confessed, then we allow them to say that sort of thing. But here, your whole argument is that she willingly undertook to do this act, and she undertook to do it against a background of facts that turned out to be wrong. You know, if they said, we're going to kidnap your daughter and keep her forever if you don't do this, and she believed that they could and would do that, do you think that would be free consent?
I disagree with your premise in that there were no facts that she was told that were wrong. They haven't presented any evidence that any of the facts that she was told were wrong. Talking about this specific case, and I think it's important when we talk about this case
to
look at these facts.
You're not being responsive. You were asked about another case, not about this.
And the reason you're being asked about another case is that we see more than our share of drug cases, and the fact is a statute book might say 40 years, but we would know that actually somebody with the particular characteristics of a given offender, and I won't be more specific than that, is going to get, you know, on average 5 years, or on average 2 years, or on average 10 years. If you look at the federal sentencing guidelines, they have astronomical, the federal statutes have very high maxima, and many, many drug offenders don't get anywhere close to that. So if she thought she was going to have 40 years, I would almost bet that's empirically not true.
It can't be a statement of fact because no one knows what would happen if she went through the system and went through on the criminal charges and got sentenced. We couldn't know
Does
that.
Does the record show if she had prior criminal convictions?
I don't know if it's in the record, but I don't believe that she did, that I'm
She's
aware
a
of.
She's a first-time offender. Okay.
I believe so. But it's important, based upon her own testimony, though, in her own deposition, what she said. When they confronted her about the criminal conduct she'd engaged in, she asked what could she do. They asked her would she be willing to become a confidential informant, and she said yes. Then
let me get back to this. Does the Fort Wayne Police Department countenance, for example, in a purchase of cocaine to show good faith that the confidential informant would then use the cocaine in front of the seller?
I don't know whether that tactic's ever been employed or not, Your Honor. I can't answer that question.
Would you counsel them to do that?
I would not.
Would you counsel them to do what they did in this case, to gauge in sex, even preserve the semen in a handkerchief and describe
I would not recommend they do that, but because I don't recommend that's a good police practice, as a matter of politics or as a matter of good judgment, doesn't necessarily make it a violation of the Constitution.
Was D'Angelo disciplined?
I don't believe he was disciplined as a result of these events at all. And it's also important to understand that Officer Alexander was arrested for a number of other criminal charges in addition to this, for which, again, there was probable cause found to believe he committed those crimes. And on summary judgment, the judge found
there was... Well, why wasn't he prosecuted?
because people like Geffert and other people that were implicated him in these other crimes changed their testimony, wouldn't testify against him. Prosecutor made a decision not to pursue the criminal charges as a result. They were pending for quite some time, and then they were dismissed as a result.
Well, what about it's trivial, but what about the cable, the cheating, television company?
The person who was involved in the friend of Alexander's that was involved in the stolen merchandise scheme where he changed barcodes and returned merchandise, he fled the jurisdiction at the time and couldn't be found anywhere at that time to testify against him. So they lost him as a witness. They lost Geffert as a witness because he refused to testify about this transaction or involvement with Alexander. So from a matter of prosecutorial discretion, they chose not to pursue the case further.
And Geffert wasn't prosecuted either.
She was
for
not.
For a drug offense.
She was not prosecuted.
Why wasn't she prosecuted? Especially after she stopped cooperating.
I can't speak for the prosecutor on that. I've never interviewed her. That prosecutor was never deposed about that decision.
Does
whether
the
or not
department has standard operating procedure with regard to the use of confidential informants?
They have procedures with respect to signing up informants and things like that, compensating them for their activities and that sort of thing, but I don't know of any procedures that deal with the use of involvement informants in situations like this.
Well, apart from, a situation like this, I hope would be highly unusual, but yes. I'm talking about other informants that might, any prohibition against committing crimes other than, say, a purchase, the use of drugs, for example, in my example?
I don't know of any standard operating procedures that deal with that subject, and it's not in the record anywhere that I can point to one way or the other. But I think it's important to focus upon the testimony of Geffert, where she says, when asked, did the police officers say anything to you that said you had to do this, had to engage in sex with Alexander in order not to face criminal charges? And she said no. She said the officers never said anything about having to do anything. She said, they asked her, would you be able to have sexual relations with Alexander? She said yes. Would you be able to do it in exchange for money? And she said yes. They didn't say ever at any point in time that she alleged that they told her she must do this in order to avoid criminal charges.
Except they told her how to preserve the evidence, that is, to spit the semen out into her handkerchief.
True. After she already had agreed to engage in oral sex with him in the police car, as she'd done before. She agreed to do that. They asked her if she would. She agreed that she would. The only evidence she has of coercion is her belief, her subjective belief, that she had to do it. No one ever told her that. She doesn't allege that they did. That was the reason Judge Lee found there was no showing of coercion, violation of due process in this case.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kane. Mr. Myers, how much time does he have? 4 minutes?
If I can make a couple of points. First, simply because a woman has sex with a man on a prior occasion should never mean that the government can compel that woman to have sex with that man again to achieve a governmental objective, and that's exactly what happened here.
Mr. Myers, what testimony were you relying on to show that she did, in fact, feel coerced?
Well, Your Honor, in my haste over there when I was listening to Mr. Keene, I happened upon page 39, which is attached to our appendix, the page 39 of Amy Geffert's deposition. And the question that was asked, and what else did you learn about that, and that is about this undercover drug operation, her answer, I learned that he was an undercover officer. I can't remember exactly how the conversation went, but they had told me that I had 2 counts of conspiracy to dealing cocaine and that could be on my record. In her response, I was surprised.
Where are you reading from?
It's actually 39 of the actual deposition.
Yeah, page 39 of the actual deposition, which is attached to our long appendices.
Oh, okay. All right.
So her response was, I was surprised. It was just like that. I said, what do I do? That's when I said, because I didn't know, I felt overwhelmed that them three were here asking me questions about this. I don't know where they were coming up with counts of conspiracy to dealing cocaine because I'm not a drug dealer, and you know. And Your Honor, repeatedly, it's cited in my factual section of my brief, Ms. Geffert, because of what happened and the way it played out, she did feel threatened.
So basically, your position is that when we read her deposition as a whole, we'll see the link up
absolutely, very clearly,
cocaine charges and her agreement to work as that maybe over on page 45, her agreement to work as
absolutely, Your Honor. Particularly when she asks, "Can I see a lawyer to see if any of this is true and see what my exposure is?" They said, "Absolutely not." In fact, they went further. They said, "We're your lawyer." We're members of the prosecutor's office and this task force. We have your interests at heart. We're your attorneys. You can't go see a lawyer. You're going to go to jail. That's exactly what happened. The second point I want to make with respect to the criminal punishment and why it wasn't realistic, my client was not predisposed to this type of crime. She's not a drug user. She's not a drug buyer. This was clearly entrapment. And it was entrapment not just to get her on this crime, but to get her for the purpose of performing sex on Nate Alexander. That was D'Angelo's design from the very beginning. The third thing I want to comment about is how a confidential informant can make a serious informed choice, particularly when the officer is presenting to her what her options are, forbid her to see an attorney. And I think that's relevant to the due process analysis because we can look at D'Angelo's conduct, all of it, from beginning to end. We don't just carve it up into certain segments. Anything else?
Okay, well, thank you very much, both counsel. Next case for